Here's Higden. It sits up nicely for Michael Higden. And what a start for Motherwell. But here's Malt, and he goes for it first time. Magnificent Malt. Stephen Robinson celebrates. Motherwell, 2-0. Could that be the goal that puts them into the Betfred Cup final?
He's got Irwin. The supporting lunge from Ainsworth on the angle. Lionel Ainsworth fires home.
It's Lasley deep into stoppage time. Up goes Sutton. No foul given. Kerr. And Reid is there to knock it in. The goal is given. Hesitation for Craig Reid, who scores his first ever goal in senior football. And what a moment for Motherwell.
Hello and welcome to the MFC podcast. Today I'm joined by a special guest who served Motherwell both as a player and also as chief executive of the football club. Pat Nevin made 58 appearances in claret and amber, combining the role of chief executive with obviously his playing role as well. He would remain at the club until April 2002, when his time came to an end following the club entering administration. This promises to be a really interesting podcast. And Pat, I'd really like to thank you for joining me today.
Absolute pleasure, no problem at all. Following up, not had many opportunities over all the years to talk about it, which is interesting and unusual, you know. And it's always good, because I've got, there are good and bad memories to that period at Motherwell. I'm always trying to remember that there were good things as well as bad.
Well, let's go right back to the start and your arrival from Kilmarnock to Firth Park. You would have played in the UEFA Cup for Kilmarnock earlier on in that season. There was a lot of to and fro, and at one point the move seemed to be dead in the water. The dual contract issue with being a player and also a director of the club was flagged up. John Boyle admitted defeat in trying to sign you. And then suddenly it was back on. How did that all come about?
Well, it's difficult to know how it all came about, other than the fact that from my perspective, what happened at the end of the previous season with Kilmarnock, I'd had a season at Kilmarnock, and it was brilliant. It was obviously, we got into the UEFA Cup. It was a really good team. Probably the happiest, kind of, arguably the happiest year I'd ever had in my career, and it had went really well. But near the end of the season, a couple of things happened. One thing is the kind of, they didn't honour a part of the contract that they said they would. And I was kind of, my attitude was very different from other players, and had been all my career. If you don't honour my contract, I'll just walk away and do something else. Fine. You know, it's more life than just playing football. And it was all about, they were supposed to, I was still living in Chester, and I had to drive up and drive back twice a week, which was quite a, you know, daunting task. Anyway, they welched in that one. And then, near the end of the season, we beat Rangers, which handed Celtic the league that year to stop 10 in a row at Ibrox. And we came in and we said, oh, yeah, great, we're going to have this European bonus, to which we were told, oh, but it's not written down in contracts, so you're not getting it. I just completely lost it. I just thought, you can't do that with people. That's like third world stuff. So I decided to say, then, look, if anything comes along, I'm just going to take it. And John had been was in contact a while after that, very soon after that, saying if I'd come. And I said, well, if you can sort it out, yeah. I wasn't mad keen on the idea of being a director, a chief executive of a club. I'd already done other works, you know, like chairman of the union in England, etc. And I didn't know really where I wanted to go. I wanted to write, I wanted to do media, I wanted to do lots of things. But after talking to John for a while, and we became more miffed at not Kilmarnock, not the fans, because I loved them, not the players, because they were fantastic, not the manager, he was different as well, but the board. And I actually passed it in on a board meeting and told them where to go, because they had kind of welched in this deal. And being a union man, I wanted to stand up for their players as well. So it got quite ugly. They're still playing me, and I managed to go an early goal in that season against Dundee United, which was one of the best goals I'd ever scored. But I knew it was going to come to an end. And John had come in, and I said, look, if you can get it happen, it can happen. There was a lot of tuning for him. I wasn't pushing for it. I was kind of quite relaxed about it one way or the other. But they came to an agreement. Eventually, they had to pay $100,000 or something like that, Motherwell, which I was really quite annoyed about. Seeing as they'd got me for nothing, paid me a pittance, refused to pay me what I was due, and then got $100,000. But, you know, that's business. That's the way they do their deals. So they went to talk to John, and he said he was buying the club. And I kind of thought, well, that's what you want to do, mate. He'd made a fantastic deal selling one of his other companies. I mean, a really stunning deal, and made a lot of money. I think the company went for about $80 million or something like that. And when he said he was going to buy a club, I said, well, yeah, you lose money out of it, mate. But, you know, if you want to do it. And he said, oh, I want to help the club. Man. Fair enough. When he asked me to become a director, I said, well, I'll do a director and oversee things for you. Then we found out quite quickly that you're not allowed to be a director and a player. Which was a bit odd at the time. And I said, well, I don't care. I don't really want to be a director. I'll just oversee it for you. But it had to come up with a title. And the only title was obvious was chief exec. And I said, well, I don't, you can call me anything you like, classically. They said, don't call me late for dinner. But if you want to say that. But I'll oversee it. So that was it. And the deal was done, moved in, joined the club. And it was kind of really odd because Harry Campbell was the manager at the time. And it must have been quite difficult for him to, and I explained to him, look, yeah, I'm overseeing it. You know, you don't need to pick me. If you want to pick me, if I'm good enough, pick me. If you don't, don't. But, you know, I'll be overseeing everything that's going on, make sure everything's tickety-boo and then seeing what's going to go ahead forward. He didn't like it. He said a couple of things in the press. And I think, like, I went and called him in. I said, look, if you're going to be like that, I need to have a word with you some of the things that have been going on. And he said, oh, I'll get back to you tomorrow. And he left. He just walked. He flew away. And it could have been nasty, and he'd said a few things, and I said in the press, look, if you want to come here and sit in front of your press, I'll just tell you exactly what's going on. He never did, and he kind of apologised for it. So, there we were. We found ourselves quite soon into the season, waiting for a new manager. I'd talked to John. I'd had a month or two to look at it, and I gave him. He asked me for, you know, how much it would cost to run this club and do it in a certain way. So I'd done all the figures. I mean, my background's economics and accounts anyway. The degree I was doing very similar to John's degree, actually. We both went to Glasgow. What is now Cali is now Tech. He'd gone there a couple of years before me, and I basically drew up three plans. One plan was, this is how you get, you know, third, fourth. So much it'll cost, probably cost you about $2 million a year. This is another way which gets you mid-table, and we can build things around it and do it slowly but surely, which would be my preferred option. And the third way, just run it the way it is just now, and we'll do the best we can and get good people in. But it's going to be hard, and you're going to fight against relegation in some years, but there you go, that's the deal. And he immediately just said, hey, we'll go for the first one then. And I was like, what? Are you joking? It's going to cost you a fortune, mate. And he said, no, that's what I want to do. And I said, well, it's your money, but it's going to cost you. As long as you know that. And he said, yeah, no, that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to do a big splash. Everybody remembered that he came in and said he wanted to be the third force. So to be the third force, I suppose he had to spend some of that money. Because, you know, forget Celtic Rangers. You know, Aberdeen had Hearts of spending vast amounts more than even that top number that I'd given him. So it was going to be, you know, tough to do that, but you know, he really wanted to do it. He wanted to make a big splash, and he certainly did at the time. I mean, anybody remembers my lot of time. Suddenly, for a team that was struggling, it was a team that was really going to try and go places. So there was a lot happening at the same time. I mean, a lot happening around the same time. Funnily enough, I've been thinking about this a lot recently because I'm currently writing a book. So eventually, you know, I'm going to have to deal with all that stuff in the book. So there's a lot of research to be done. I've kept all the papers, etc. But so many things happen at the same time. So I'm trying to play. You're trying to structure an organisation. Have to then decide on a new manager. And all the changes that have to be done going forward. John wanted to spruce up the place as well. Spend money on, you know, upstairs. Get, you know, lots of different things. He had brilliant ticketing ideas, which was to decrease the prices while increasing the quality of the play and the players, which... it's a bit wild, really. People kind of forget that he was doing that. He was coming up with initiatives like you know, let women in for free, kids in for free for a load of games, just to say, look, we're on your side with the fans. They didn't always work, and sometimes they actually completely and utterly backfired. But, you know, it was quite modern thinking, a lot of modern thinking. I mean, one of the things that, again, people forget, there was a statement issued at the club, and it's the club's statement of beliefs, which was written by myself, John, and a couple of others. And it basically says we are against racism, sexism, homophobia, you name it, all stuff that, like, you say it now and it all sounds perfectly sensible. That was my head back then. So lots of things going on at the time, but I think first thing was definite attitudes manager. And that was tough. So my sort of background and all our backgrounds, and it was, you look within your own organisation to see what there is there. And in that dressing room, there was plenty of interesting people in there. Specifically, there was Owen Coyle and Billy Davis, who both clearly wanted to go into coaching. Nearing the end of their careers, it kind of quite quickly, in my mind, came down a choice between the two of them. Brian McClure had come on board as well. Brian, I think John's idea was originally Brian and I could do it, you know, a manager and assistant manager. But I said, no, I don't want to be a manager. I don't think I'd be a very good manager. And it's not something I've ever wanted to do. And Brian he was quite laid back with me, saying, well, no, there are people who are much more dedicated to coaching and management specifically. And we both looked at, you know, them. So anyway, I pulled for Billy Davis, not because he was better or worse than Owen. Really, the pushing factor was quite simply, I needed Owen at centre forward. He was scoring goals for us and he was great for it. And the idea of him, you know, falling away from that would have been a big mess. It didn't work in the end because I think Billy then sidelined Owen quite quickly. Whether that's because he didn't rate him, he got too old, whether he felt it's a threat, I don't know. It doesn't matter. But that's kind of what happened. So with a huge amount happening in the first period, one of the worst things that happened is the Oswald youngsters, Andy, who had cardiomyopathy, you know, years later. I was actually in the midst of trying to set up a heart screening at the club, because in England, with the PFA, I'd set up the heart screening via the PFA for all players that were coming in to every single club. When I came up here and I found out it wasn't being done in Scotland, I thought, what the hell? I couldn't believe it. I knew it would cost, didn't care. And then the week we started setting up, we lost Andy. Never got to him quick enough. We never knew. So that was a horrible time at the club, and in a fairly initial period. Because Andy was one of the best and funniest and brightest and liveliest kids you'll ever know. He was only a kid, but he was the first team used to their best mates. So, and amongst all the stuff that was going on, I mean, that's just a tiny little snapshot, but there's a million other things going on with tickets and things like that. Another thing that I suppose wasn't preying in my mind, but it was preying in a lot of other people's mind. People were saying, oh, Pat's there controlling Billy Davis. I'm like, yeah, right. You don't know Billy Davis. I just said, look, every single player in that dressing room can go and jump the manager's door and say, I should be playing, except one. Me, I can't do that because I chose the manager and I trust his judgment, and I never could. I made myself open for advice, but really not very often. Billy did sort of very rarely, you know, had his own ideas, and that was perfectly reasonable, and I kind of respected him for that. I did do one thing. I gave him one player. I said, I've got a player, I can get him for a certain amount of money, he's unbelievably cheap for what he's going to give us. If you don't like him, you don't like him, but I think he'll do a job for you. So I got Jed Brannan in. Knew Jed Brannan from my days at Tranmere. I ended up, Jed played centre midfield, centre half, he was a skipper. And he played basically the whole time. And Billy, I think, rated him very highly. Not just as a player, but as a person as well.
There's a few things that I'd just like to touch on from the initial stages. First would be the ticketing initiatives. I think it was £5 and £1 for kids, a home game against Dunfermline, and then a Sunday evening game against Dundee United. Fir Park, packed with Motherwell fans, a really good atmosphere. The games at that time weren't great. I think it was a 0-0 and a a drab 1-0 victory against United. There's the famous picture of Harry Campman having signed a raft of players all standing beside a tractor on the pitch. I'm not sure what the significance of the tractor was, but we can debate that another day. The quality of signing was rather questionable. How did you feel coming in a wee bit later when all these guys have been signed? You're the chief exec. The team aren't, or they haven't, hit the ground running. Is there concerns over the quality of player and the standard?
As a player, I mean, I'm playing with them. Mm-hmm. You know, okay, so I've been a Scottish international. I've played at the top level of England for a decade. To take that in consideration, it wouldn't be at that level. But some of the players were really quite a distance below. I mean, there was one or two that were very, very good. I mean, Ateo was not a bad player. Duisburg, had come in. I can't remember if Duisburg came in after or before that. But, you know, there were one or two that were good enough. But the vast majority were really miles off of the standard that we were looking for. Certainly, even the Motherwell beforehand would have been looking for. I didn't think they were up to that standard. And one player in particular, I actually wasn't convinced he'd ever played football professionally before. And it turns out he hadn't. We bought him for a lot of money. Apparently, he'd been playing for the basketball team. And it was kind of, I didn't like that. I thought that sounded uncomfortable, especially if money was being paid out to agents. And that was something I was very much against. If an agent, if we got a player, quite simply, my first question always to the agent was, you have to play the agent? Answer, yes. Good. He'll pay you, not me, not the club. You know, whereas then, and more so now, the club pays the agent, and the player often pays the agent, and the selling club pays the agent. It's a nonsense, and it's something I think is absolutely grotesque within the game. You know, there's also a double standard that can happen there. You know, I absolutely wouldn't accept that, but that had been happening and I didn't like it. So that was one of the things that, I mean, I can't say, oh, they done that and got that player because they were getting, you know, money in via an agent. I can't say that because I have no evidence of that, but there is that danger that that could have been the case, and I don't like that. So I looked at the quality of a lot of the players, and, you know, lovely lads, them all got on very, very well with them all, but there were quite a few of them just were miles away from being good enough. And Billy, I agree.
I assume the player we're talking about there is Holm Kraska, who...
Yeah, it was Holm. I mean, really, any Motherwell fan has seen him. I mean, lovely guy, but really, can he play? And it's a shame, really, because it wasn't his fault. You know, and I really like Holm, and, you know, Holm, I'd got him in the office once, and he basically said to me he hadn't played at any level. So, I mean, I'm going to go back and look at all my books in the next few months. Because John had given me this one great piece of advice, John, but I said, whatever happens, write down at the end of every day what you've done in a red and black folder. And I did. So, and I've never looked at them since. And I'm going over the next number of months. And I've dipped into some of them, but those sort of discussions, there was a guy, Hervey, who was the centre forward, brought in from France. And he played a wee bit, but to tell you how difficult it was for him, when we were having training sessions, if someone was having a bad day, people just said, you're having a herve. That's how bad it was. So, you know, it was that standard. It may well be he was great somewhere else, but it wasn't for us. So there was a number of people that came in that it just was miles away. But there you go, that was the previous regime. Don't sit and cry about it. Move on. You put your own plans in place, and we tried to do that as quickly as we could.
Well, that certainly happened quickly, and Billy's first game was a 5-0 defeat at McDermott Park, but he would follow that up with a victory over Rangers. John Spencer and Jed Brannan had both come in. Spencer scores the winner on his debut. The fans got right behind this loan signing at the time, and come January, the fans were desperate to see Spencer remain at Fir Park. It was a big money deal. Debatably, it didn't really work out following the move being made permanent. A big money signing, a marquee signing, But was that a step too far, given the budget? Was that a signing within the budget?
Well, I didn't want it. I like Spenny. You know, obviously, he's similar to me. He played at Everton and Chelsea and we played at Scotland, all that sort of stuff. He was a massive character, huge character. He's also the manager's brother-in-law. But I didn't care because he was a good player. It was nothing got to do with that. But I'd said to John, like, well, I've got a budget here. You've got to let me do my job. And you bring Spenny in with that. Those costs. There's no way. The budget's dead. And worse than that, every single other player's going to turn around and go, how come he's getting that and I'm not getting that? And that's just the way football works. I've been in football long enough to know that. But there was a statement that wanted to be made. You know, there was an uncertainty with many Motherwell fans. We say it was all positive about John coming in and buying the club, but the previous owners had been with the club for so long, and they were at the club. And for a new guy to come in brash, a wee bit brasher, a bit money bags from the outside, you know, he had to basically sort of make friends with the fans. Now, what's the best way to make friends? I suppose it's going to give them a nice big present. And Spenny was being, you know, howled for in some of the games, and I understood that, but I'd said to John and the board, look, I'm really uncomfortable. I love him, it's great. So John was eventually to come up with a plan of, right, we'll get him, but it's not out of your budget. And I went, well, how can I say the manager's sitting there, and how can I say the manager, I'm still not wanting him? Impossible, you know. Billy's saying he's desperate to get this player. So, you know, I understood when I was B, but B, I just said, look, I'm not doing that deal. I'll come down and watch it and listen and talk and advise, but it wouldn't be my names and contracts and all that sort of stuff. I'm not going to do the intricacies of that because I don't agree with it. And that's what happened. You know, I understood why the club wanted to do it. But if you're talking, if I'm saying it's going to be costing up towards $2 million a year, Spenny's contracts have a big percentage of that, a big old percentage of it. Not, you know, not half or anything like that, but a big percentage of that. We need them more than just a centre forward. We needed a lot of players, you know. So, you know, it didn't work with how I saw the budget, but, you know, I'm not the owner. And it wasn't coming out of my budget, so I couldn't really say no. And then Spenny turns up, and hilariously, he's big. He gets a car written in his contract, and then turns up with, I think it was a £68,000 Jag. So, you're not taking the piss, are you? But it was, to be honest, John just laughed at it. He just thought it was, you know, it was quite funny. And at the time, that sort of money, to put it in perspective, my attitude towards money at the time, my attitude was, John had given me a contract, or offered me a contract as a player and as chief exec. My first question was half that, just half it. Now, when's the last time you had anybody else doing that in football? Because football don't do that. But my heart was doing the right thing. No, that's not what you deserve to pay. This is what the going rate should be. And John went, oh, that's fine. And I think there was a real trust upon there. Because I have to remember, in the midst of all this, I didn't actually really know John Boyle that well. I'd only met him, you know, on a number of occasions, handful of occasions in my life. So he had to try and find out what a person, sort of person I was. By the end, I think I got a wee bit fed up with this kind of honourable attitude that I got a bit tiresome for him. Indeed, to the degree that he once called me, oh, shut up, St. Patrick.
The signings kept on coming. The Andy Gorham, Tony Thomas, Don Goodman came in on loan. The Andy Gorham one wasn't without its controversies as well. Now, you're still playing at the time. You've got all these responsibilities away from the 90 minutes on a Saturday. The press attention was massive at that. How difficult a signing was that to manage? And then, obviously,
I didn't mind the signing. I thought Andy was above and beyond what we could afford. I also thought it was worth it. I'm 100%. I played with him with Scotland. I know how good he was. And he didn't seem to have lost anything. He just seemed to be as good as God. There was baggage with Andy. Everybody knew that. But you hope that you're able to manage that, and Billy felt strongly he could manage it. But once again, I didn't like the size of the contract was too big. And similarly, the only two that didn't really get involved in was Billy, with Andy, and Spenny. The other two I wouldn't do because they took me outside what I felt was the spending regime that we should have. As again, underlined, not to say they weren't worth it, that was the value, that was the correct value. It was just too much for Motherwell. But the goalie came in, and when he came in, you know, you shrug your shoulders, get on with it, and you realize, because Stevie Woods was there beforehand, he's a very good goalkeeper in himself. But Andy came in, and honestly, that gave the place a real lift. Because in training, every training, it only happened to me once before, and it very rarely happens in anybody's career, never mind twice. But we would stop during the training to applaud the goalie, the players. He would do these incredible things, which were like, you know, physics just kind of didn't make sense the way he'd make some of these saves. We'd just be laughing at how brilliant it was. Now, that's happened to me before with Neville Southall down at Everton. He was just that ridiculously good. And Andy was a world-class goalkeeper. And I don't... you know, there's lots of international-class people around, but he's world-class at his very best. But as we know, there was some baggage as well. And there was one particular event that happened, which was back page and front page, when there was an alleged threat by... And I say alleged, underlined three times in red, alleged threat by the IRA to kill him during a game. That was a tough one to manage. And I didn't think it was realistic. And Billy didn't either, neither did John Boyle. And the goalie said, yeah, but you're not the one in the sights, you're the one standing in the goals. And there was a Celtic game coming up. And in the end, it was a horrible, horrible time that time. And that was some of the stuff we had to deal with the goalie. Eventually, he decided not to play. And that led to complications because it was a no-win situation. And you know, if you do game theory stuff, sometimes there is a no-win. So what you do is you take the best loss. And that's what we took at the time. And he didn't play in that game, even though Billy and myself and John thought he should do. And he didn't. The problem is, I went to the press and said, the goalie's not playing. We've had a discussion between the four of us and we've decided what we're playing. And the next day, the press went with, Billy Davis will not allow Gorham to play. And I threw that back to the press and said, look, did all the press stuff and I said, hey, turn off the recorders now, just to tell you exactly what happened. And explained that we all thought he should play, but the goalie felt he couldn't do it, it was too dangerous. He's got a wife, his children, his everything, and his own danger as well. And it was him. And I said, don't ever go at Billy Davis about it. But all I was trying to do, I didn't lie, all I was trying to do was just to say, look, deflected slightly on the four of us. I mean, the guy's under serious, serious pressure. And I was just trying to help. And I want to be honest with you guys. Next thing in the press, Nevin lies to the press. Headline. And I thought, oh, well, there's no such thing, off the record then. But even that, you know, it didn't, and nothing had bothered me because I'd been 17, 18, 19 years in the game. I'd been the guy in the PFA that had to go and stand up for Eric Cantona when he drop-kicked the guy at Crystal Palace. Don't worry, I've been there. I know these things happen. I know they're hard. I know they actually, it will pass. And it will go somewhere else. As long as you're strong by your beliefs and do what you think's right, I think that's important.
Come the end of the season, the team had finished in seventh place. At that point, do you start to reconsider your aims and your ambitions? There's obviously been a lot of money spent, and albeit Billy took over from a team that were struggling at the wrong end of the table, it didn't improve to the level that maybe John or the supporters, given the calibre of the signings, expected?
I'd explain to John, it's like an oil tanker. You don't turn around in 2 minutes. People who think you can change everything right away, it's amazing how rarely that actually happens. Especially there's a massive culture around it. So I'd explain to John, first season, you just stay safe. All you do is try and stay safe. You need to build it up. The manager's learning, I'm learning. The players are learning to work with each other. We're slowly but surely, as the season and the year goes by, trying to build something that's a structure. It's just almost impossible. And remember, we saved a lot of money. It wasn't a lot of money in comparison to the other teams we're playing against. You know, the teams we play had double our budgets, like Hudson Hart and Aberdeen. It still had double our budgets, whatever we were doing. So you kind of walks in there and saying, right, we'll go and do all that. John was telling me about we wanted the third floor, and I'm saying, John, it's not helpful. It's not really helping, mate. But he said, we need to get people, it's marketing, we need to get people through the door, and I got that. I understood that as well. But I'm very much slowly, catchy, as it were. You don't, things are done too quickly. You know, they're not built in stable kind of foundations. So I wasn't over concerned about that at all. The next season, I wanted us to make a real push and get up towards that sort of area, and that was an important thing. And in every board meeting and every meeting with John, that I underlined it. And I also underlined to Billy, hey, it's about this season's safety and security and learning. Next season is about doing something. Of course, we want to win every game, and you go out trying to win every game. But I certainly don't think that. And fans will think that. Of course they do. That's what everything has to happen yesterday or tomorrow, and certainly today at the latest. But I didn't think that way. And I think if you think that way, there's danger still, as it proves to be. If you do go too quickly, there are dangers.
Ahead of the 1999-2000 season, the transfers kept coming. The likes of Greg Strong, Kevin Twaddle, Sasa Churchich, Don Goodman signed in a permanent deal. The season started with you getting your first goal for Motherwell and a 2-2 draw against Hibs. You seemed to like the first game of the season. You had scored in the first game of the season for Kilmarnock the season before. Were you coming back that bit fresher than everyone else?
Well, I don't know. When I came to Kilmarnock originally, I had to get a match fit, but that didn't take long. Well, what it was actually understanding the league and understanding the players, and your players understanding you. And when that happened at Kilmarnock, after a very short time, it was great. And I had a brilliant season, really good season at Kilmarnock, and the second season started off well as well. So I still thought I could play. Now, the problem with Motherwell, I wasn't getting enough games, and I'm pretty busy doing other things. But you start the season, you're up there and you're fit and you're ready and you're best. No, I was getting on a bit, but I still felt I was capable. So, you know, scoring that goal against Hibs, which is hilarious now when you think about it. I think it was a header. How dare I score a header? Big Jake nodded down a header and I scored it. And you just think, you thought, well, this could be absolutely great. But then I'll get very, very few starts after that, you know. You know, the manager has to do his own thing. And our players like Todd and Sasha were coming in. And, you know, he's got them in, he's got to play them. I accepted that. I was gutted because I love playing football, but I accepted, like, you're getting a bit older and not going to be able to do it. But I still absolutely felt I could do a job and try to get myself in good enough nick. So, from a personal point of view, maybe somewhere in the back of my mind, but to be fair, I had other things in my mind. So it's a club to help run. You know, to underline this just now, by the way, we had some great people working in there. You know, Arthur Barron had done a fantastic job as coming in as secretary, taking a massive amount of the stress off of me. And we worked together. It took a wee while, but we got to have like a really good working relationship. Arthur was never a football man in a million years, and I thought that was a good thing. That's a really good thing, but it led to some you know, problems and mistakes, you know, because you need to understand the culture of football. But that's what I was there for, to make sure that, you know, we caught them as quickly as we could and moved on. But for me, it was, I'll still keep on trying to work at it, but it was going to be really difficult. You mentioned I played 58 games. Well, of them, I don't know how many were starts, but I'm guessing it was much less than half.
Well, I'm going to keep it on the football for just a minute or two. The form at the start of that season wasn't great. And then it comes to a midweek game against an Aberdeen side whose form was even worse. And one end of the park, you've got Andy Gorham between the sticks. Jim Leighton at the other end, Scotland's number one and two. Which way you rank them depends on personal preference, I guess. But two fantastic goalkeepers. So inevitably, the game ends Motherwell 5, Aberdeen 6. Aberdeen couldn't buy a goal at that point either. Just a completely bonkers game of football. Can you sum up that night?
No. Try to get your head around that. It was unbelievable because you think, we've actually got a decent team here. There's some of the defenders are all right as well. And we've got an amazing goalkeeper. Sorry, what season was this? Remember the year? What year was it?
This was 99.
99, 2000. So, you know, so you build all these things up and then something like this comes out of nowhere and you think, I can't get my head around this, and you didn't know how to take it. And basically, you know, I took it with your beat. So, well, guys, that was what it was really down to. We were absolutely gutted about that. But you're also thinking, every game we attack, we're going to score. And it was an exciting thing to be part of. It was a brilliant thing to be part of. And you said, look, if you're not scoring goals, you've got a big problem. There's a lot of things you've got to do. If you're leaking goals, that's something that we've got an easier thing to fix. You know, certainly from my point of view, looking at it, if you lose a lot of goals, you look at that personnel and you structure them and you work them to death as in pure structure. Creation's harder. So in actual fact, you know, gutted though I was, you know, and sure Billy was as well, there was a wee bit of you thinking, you know what? There's still something there. There's still a right good chance at this point in time of going forward and continuing to score a lot of goals, but being competitive. And I certainly felt that at the time. But there was always going to be tough times. And the other thing I remember is, you know, some of the other teams that are above us, you know, see the likes of Celtic, the players they had in their team at the time. I mean, just ridiculous, the standard of players they had in the team. And they have probably been paying for players more than their whole budget. So, no different then from what it is now. But that was the tricky thing we had. We had to try and keep calm under situations like that. There was, I can't remember when it was, but there was a 7-0 against Celtic once. And yeah,
I think that was the game that Andy actually missed out, wasn't it? It was a 7-1 at Fir Park.
We got a player sent off, didn't it?
Yeah, Spencer was sent off in that game, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember thinking, like, and Rangers, they sent a right good team. I mean, a right good team at the time. And that could happen. The important thing was to actually keep your head straight and say, no, keep it sensible. Know that that's not our competition. We'll try and give them a bloody nose when we can, and we did over the years, a few times, both Celtic and Rangers. But in the midst of it all, no, the competition's elsewhere, and we need to make sure we're up to them. And if you think of Aberdeen, they still were a team that, again, you look at budget, they were, you know, miles ahead of us at that time in budget. So, you know, don't get too downhearted about it, but, God, it was a confusing one, let's just say.
Personally, for you, had a big moment when you grabbed the winner in a rearranged game against Hearts, a last-minute goal to seal a 2-1 victory. The form did improve as well, and we would end the season narrowly missing out in European football, finish with a win over Rangers, but Hearts would beat Hibs in the final day to secure that third spot. Inevitably so close to that aim of being the third force within a short period of time as well.
It was millimetres away. You think about it, 2 points. It's kind of, I remember being disappointed because you are disappointed because you aim high. We were miles away from the team below St Johnson. We had really pushed it that close. But then, you know, we spent some money. Getting there that quickly probably surprised me. Getting that close that quickly probably surprised me. You're right, going back to that game against Hearts, the midweek game, and I scored the winning goal in that game. I think it was with 6 seconds to go. and it was, that was probably a moment. I remember after the game thinking, actually, there's footage on it. I scored the goal and they cut away and then cut back to Billy and then cut back to me in the camera. And I'm kind of looking up towards the sky and I'm thinking, do you know what? We might be close here. We actually might be close to being, because Hearts were a good team. And that's who we had to kind of gauge ourselves against, and we'd managed to beat them in the last minute. It was nice being the guy who scored it. What was actually funny about that is when I scored that goal, the amount of players that ran over and jumped on top of us. Now, they quite liked the bonus, but do you know, if you're not popular with the players, they're not going to do that in that sort of way. And that was another nice thing as well, thinking, nah, still accepted by the gang. That's okay. You know, it's a very, very tricky tightrope to walk, because you're doing contracts, you're doing all these things, and if anyone's miffed, if you're an executive, chief executive, the buck stops with you and it ends up coming back to you. But we still managed to kind of walk that tightrope at that point in time. And then got to that final game of the season where we managed to beat Rangers, which was my final ever game of professional football. It was nice to beat Rangers in that kind of final game. And you're right, it was very, very close indeed. And you could go through that whole season and look at a number of times where we hit the post. Had it gone in, we might have got, you know, more points instead of a draw, you know, and that might have made all the difference. It was that close, it was that tight.
The next season, and I don't mean to brush over it, but given what had happened previously and what happens after that, it was a significantly quieter season. The team had finished ninth, and the significant transfers were outgoings. Stephen McMillan and Lee McCulloch both leaving the club to join Wigan Athletic. Now, I've got the benefit of having spoken to you a couple of weeks ago and knowing a bit more about this transfer now. And what you were telling me was the initial fee that was agreed was substantially lower than the £1.75 million reported to have been received in the outcome.
Oh, it was well less than half a million. Miles less than the original agreed fee, which was done without my knowledge. And I was fuming. And just quite simply said, if you do that... Because what had happened, there had been cash flow problems. And I, again, I knew what the Motherwell situation was. But remember, there was, you know, question marks over television deals, whether John's company had cash flow problems as well, because they were the ones that were funding the losses. Or, you know, he wouldn't have said losses, he would have said the inputs of cash. And at that point, then you needed some. And I said, fine, that's okay. I've been in the background expecting this. I've been trying to get as many of our kids through. I've been working hard, sorting out who should do the youth development and make sure it's as good as good can be. Billy was well on with that because he comes from the youth department himself. Had he been the youth manager, you know, before he, as well as playing before he became the manager, he brought in David McParland, who was among the business as well, you know, in the early days. So I had put this plan B in place. You know, that, you know, when the trouble, if and when the trouble happened, we've got something that can get us out of it. But to then be told, no, we're going to do this without your knowledge, I said, that's fine, do it, but I'm leaving. So they left me to re-engage with Wigan. In the end, we got a better and a more substantial fee. And I'm always upfront about it. It was hard to get that. It's hard when you've got an agreement and suddenly people come back and they want three times more than they thought they were paying. But they knew that it was just dodgy anyway. So eventually got it, but then I went to sign it, sell ons, and they said, well, you can only have one. And I chose Stephen McMillan, because he was a brilliant left back. I knew his capabilities, and I thought he could go to the very top. And I didn't choose Big Lee, which was a shame, really, because Studs got injured. His career didn't go as the way it should have gone, purely because of this arm injury. And Big Lee would have got some money back into the club for the selling. Not a stupid amount, not millions, but certainly would have got, you know, a few hundred grand a few years later, which by that time would have been very helpful for Motherwell, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And was that a kind of indication of what was to come, and that the gap between English football and Scottish football would start to widen, with both players being flown in to Wigan by helicopter and things like that, the kind of the brazenness of English football and the money that's thrown at it. This is a League One team, I would Wigan.
Well, I knew it was there and it was growing anyway, and it was all about television money. Now, I've been involved in television deals for years during the PFA. You know, we were part of the negotiations. We knew where the money was and where it was coming in. That's why I thought if we develop youngsters, there's a massive big market sitting down there that's going to win them if we need to do this. So, you know, I'd had a friend at the time, and again, I don't know if I've told you this before, but a friend of my time at the time had taken over another club in Scotland, and he wanted me to leave Motherwell and come and work with him. So Ivano Benetti up at Dundee, he'd said he was going to buy all these big players. And he told me he was going to buy, and I went, are you mad? I thought we were pushing it a bit against Spenny. The players he started talking about was unbelievable. And I'd said, oh, come on, you're off your head. And he said, no, because we can resell them on. The difficulty after that obviously came with lots of things changed. You know, Bosman was really became used by the players really well, and some of those sell-ons became harder when players had run out of contract. By the time Ivano actually wanted me up, that season I stopped playing, by the way. I could have been playing for Dundee with Ivano and being an executive role up there. How mad was that? Happily I didn't do that, because that was another one that went pear-shaped. So, and Ivano was a great mate, and still is a great mate, like, and one of the best, just a fabulous football player as well. But in the midst of it, there's lots, as you say, lots and lots going on, but there's a lot of money spent around the game. Problem is, not a lot of it was in Scotland, or not a lot of it was in Scotland firm. And by now that you start getting problems with TV deals, you start getting problems with, you know, arguments over the next deals and how much Celtic Rangers won in comparison to everybody else. There's beginning to become real pressure. Now, I'm involved in all these committees because I'm the only one that can do it in Motherwell, really. If you've got any committee or any management structure within the league and you need a representative, well, it's not going to be anybody else at the club who's, you know, doesn't have a background in football, because John didn't and Alistair didn't really. It kind of had to be me, and I'd done all the PFA and I'd been on every committee down in England anyway, so I knew how it worked. But at that point in time, it was really beginning to get toxic. In hindsight, it's because everybody knew the money was getting squeezed, particularly in comparison to the inverted commas competitors down south.
We'll move on to your final season at the club, 2001-2002. Only a month into the season, Billy Davis is sacked. Maybe looking back, the point in time where things began to escalate, things started to move in a bit of a downwards direction. How difficult was
it was before that, actually. there'd been a fallout with Billy and most of the board. At that point in time, I was the only guy on the board backing Billy. And there wasn't many people in the stands backing them as well. And that was really kind of difficult, because I brought Billy in. I knew he was a good manager, but Billy's not the easiest person to work with all the time for everybody. And John had fallen foul of him as well. They kind of fallen. That's not unusual in football clubs. And you know, I said, but no, he's a good manager. But in the end, when it was decided, look, it's not working under Billy, it was obviously, you do it, Pat. Thanks very much, cheers. I'm the only one that's backed him for the past 6 or 9 months. I'm the one that's getting given the job. But I was happy. I'd rather. So I had to go and talk to Billy. And he was perfectly reasonable and good about it. And, you know, he just shrugged his shoulders and said, right, I'll get a lawyer to talk to you and all that. And I went, yeah, I'll do my best for you. And told everybody that this guy's going to be a good manager. In fact, he's going to be a really good manager. Him leaving here is not saying I don't think he's any good. It's not that. It's just the situation we're in just now. And people just thought that was a bullshit line. It wasn't. It's absolutely straight up. And turns out to be absolutely true as well. Because, you know, Billy did go on to do very good things, down south. And that didn't surprise me in the slightest. But at that point in time, what had been clear is the finances weren't going to be the way they were before. The original plan that John had come up with, he wouldn't stay by. And I understood it. I did. I got it. And there was a bit of me, if I'm absolutely honest, was quite pleased. I didn't feel that comfortable with that sort of money that's been thrown about. I'd explained to him, look, I can get your budget back. Would you need your budget back down there? And he told me, and I went, good, give me 6 months, it'll be there. And we'll still be, if not competitive at the top, but we'll still be safe. Because we've got a lot of kids in. We've got a lot of young lads just about to break through. We've done our work here. And there's still enough decent players around. So, and you've got good people working for you. But that's hard for Billy. Because Billy wants to, I've not yet met the manager. I've not met any managers who will say, oh yeah, just decrease my budget by £1 million a year and smile about it. You know, it's not easy. And I think that was hard for Billy to take. And do you know what? I was fine with that. And I understood that. And so there wasn't any great fallout with myself and Billy. But I knew that the finances had completely changed by that point in time. The problem is you kind of go out in the public and go, by the way, we're skin. And you know, change everything. And we don't want to spook all the players and all the fans. You need to go and try and rework it down to a sensible level. And I looked at our squad that we had at the time, and it was still all right. It was still good enough. You know, the likes of, you mentioned Greg Strong before, and Benito Kembele came in and he'd done a really good job for us. And the work rate of the guys, and Stuart Elliott came in and scored a load of goals for us. All those young players, like, we've talked about this before, but, you know, Lashley, McCullough, Pearson, Faddy, you know, you think, actually, that looks all right. I quite like that. But it wasn't going to be a team that was going to go and charge up to third place. No, it got away from that. Others hadn't really cut the costs. I was trying very, very hard to get it back down to what we then agreed was the new budget, and well on the way to doing that as the season went on. But it meant, you know, selling Stephen, Stelling, Big Lee, but there's still enough there.
John Philbin and Mia Drag Crockett did pretty well in the temporary spell in charge, and then it would be Eric Black and Terry Butcher who would come in on a permanent basis. Eric Black was highly thought of, was highly sought after. How big a coup was that for Motherwell, getting a manager like Eric Black to the football club?
Can you go back to Mio and John Philbin just for a minute? They were in charge for a while together as a duo, and to Motherwell fans, it looked like a dream team. John and I had known each other since we were 17. We'd played in Scottish Youth together. In fact, we'd won Euro Championships under 18s together. Mio is fabulous. He's just one of the best guys I've ever met in my life. And I thought at the time, hey, what a double act that'll be. No. Freaking not. They were not a duo. They wouldn't work together. It was going to be either or of those two. And it just, that happens. And some people want to work as a duo, some people don't. So I left it in a wee while to see if it was going to get, you know, it was going to kind of gel. But 100%, I mean, 100%, not get 100% wasn't going to work. And both of them were open to say that to me, that it was good of them to do that. But I'd been looking around anyway, because you always have to look around. Eric, I'd watched, and everybody had said what a good coach he was anywhere he'd done coaching. I knew Eric again since I was very young in Scotland. I'd watched him in Scotland, I watched him in youth, and I just thought, this guy could be really, really special as a manager. As a coach, he was second to none. There was a number of people that at that time I was thinking about. Stevie Clark was, you know, it was funny now, he's a Scotland manager, but Clarky was one of my best pals as well. Numbers of people, but Clarky was still playing at that point. And there's numbers of people thinking that, but I just kept on thinking, I've got to try and speak to Eric. So I took I think there was about 100 and odd, I can't remember, 100 and odd people who had applied. And there were 30 or 40 there that were of interest. There was that much interest in the club. But I went to see Eric, and as soon as I spent time with him, I thought, oh, do you know, that would be absolutely fantastic. His plans, to bring Terry Butcher with him, to bring George Adams with him, who was the best in the business of youth, because if we were going to make a change, everything was going to change. You know, Davian Parland, unfairly and sadly for him, would be going as well. And it was a shame for him, because, you know, him and Billy's fallout, that had been a big, big part of it, a big, big problem for us. And it was maybe the biggest problem at the club, was the fallout between Billy and David. So I just thought, no, clean break. We need a new person in, need to have complete control. That's just the way it goes. And when I talked to them and when I listened to them, I just thought, I'll work with these people forever. Introduced them to John, and John was like, wow, how fantastic is this going to be? Explained the financial position, the difficult financial position to Eric. Eric seen it exactly as I did. He said, good, that's what we want it to be.
We want it to be real. We want it to be a real club. We want to be, build it with our knowledge and under a budget that's sensible, and be able to develop something that we see that's not just throwing money at it. And so I'm thinking, God, I'm dying and going to heaven here with the right people. So everyone was, it was just brilliant. Terry was, you know, everyone thought, why wouldn't Terry Bitcher be the manager and Eric be second? Now, you need to know them. Terry would have been much better than number two. And he felt that as well. And Terry and I knew each other, of course, obviously, famously were cousins, but only through marriage. People never knew that, didn't know that at the time, but that's not where I got a job. It was Eric that brought him in. So I brought this team in. Secretly, I had another thing. They were my replacements. George Adams was coming in, and anything that I was doing, he could do. So I could see I was immediately putting in my replacements, and I felt really comfortable about that because I was never going to do a long period of time in that job. In simple terms, it wasn't really that much fun most of the time. And there were a lot of things in my life I wanted to do. But what I wanted to do was leave in a fairly strong position with good management. So when Eric came in, I would say for a very short period of time, I don't know, can you remember when he came in? You got a date of when he came in?
I think that would have been November 2001 that Eric came in.
Yeah. So we'd had a stinker of a start to the season, real awful start to the season. It was only one win out of the first 10 games or so. And then we had a good little period, but then after that it was just up and down kind of thing. But what the most important thing was, this is a complete restructure. We need to change this, we need to change the finances of it, and that's going to take a wee while. John was in with it, you know, the people at his Hammond portfolio, the company oversaw his finances, they were good with it as well. They liked Eric, everything felt great. And oddly enough, for that very short period, it's probably one of my happiest times at Motherwell. How strange does that sound now? Because I thought, no, we have got brilliant, brilliant top level people, and this is going to be great fun. And I had to then just spend a lot of time trying to explain to John, trust me in this, this is good, this is really good, and the budget's down where it should be, we can go on and build something really nice here. But there were other pressures, and the other pressures were coming from the outside that, you know, they wanted to cut the cost in such a way that was putting in the administration. And as soon as I'd heard that and wages started to get held up because of cash flow, I just thought the money men from the other side are now completely controlling it, and we're losing that even in the trust in what we were going to be doing afterwards. I tried to explain that what was a very important thing, which I felt was, we can run this, it'll take us a wee while, we've got sellable assets, there will be doubts for the moment, but don't worry, I know that these sellable assets will be sold and we'll get it back. Oh, and by the way, if you want to sell, I've got a buyer for you, because I'd done that in the background as well. So I'd covered as many bases as I possibly could at that point in time.
So come April 2002 and everything changes, the club enters administration, there's that picture of you sitting in the steps at Fir Park looking absolutely devastated by how things have unfolded. How difficult a process was that? There's obviously a number of people potentially losing their jobs, a number of people did lose their jobs, the future of the club was in serious jeopardy, or from the outside it certainly seemed to be in serious jeopardy.
I didn't agree with that at all. No, you're right. From there, a number of things, it was horrible. People wouldn't have understood what I thought. When it was agreed to go to the administration, just 2 days before, I think a day or two before, actually, funny enough, I was having a serious health scare at the time, which is really weird. Because I was kind of, there was a possibility that I'd had cancer at that point in time, so it turned out it wasn't. I needed a new hip. But I was going through that at the time, and right in the days that was happening. And I kept on trying to explain to him, no, I've got this. We've got this. this is fine. If we've not got it, don't put it in administration. And they said, why not? I said, look, quite simply, you'll end up sacking some people who don't deserve to be sacked. I'm a union man at heart as well. You're getting rid of people, you'll probably re-sign again on half the money. That looks like a scam. That's not on. You shouldn't do that. A contract's a contract, it's supposed to be some people. It means something. There's local community people that are going to lose. You know, the people that are providing the pies and providing everything, you're going to be going right off there. The money that you could put in that business. You can't do that in a whim. And if you're going to do that, don't. I'll just go and get a buyer in and we'll carry on. They absolutely wouldn't take my arguments at all. John said at the time to both Eric and I, we want you after administration to stay on and run it. And he said that financially it's going to be very good for you to do that. Eric and I just looked at each other and went, be serious. You think it's about money with us? You don't know us at all if you think that. And both of us said, no, we will not do that. But we pleaded with Terry, who was not part of it. You know, he wasn't part of the management. He was just assistant manager. He said, no, Terry, you can stay. Don't worry about that. But for us, we absolutely wouldn't accept that. We couldn't accept the morality of getting rid of people's contracts, the damage it was doing to the community, the damage it was doing to other people that you couldn't afford to lose, you know, lose a lot of businesses, all those sort of things. And we also both felt strongly that it didn't need to go into administration. So when you see me sitting outside, that probably looks like me fed up for me. I couldn't give a stuff about my situation. I'm alright, I'll be fine. I've got other jobs I can do. I mean, I was already doing a lot of other media stuff at the time. I was ready, I had a million different things in my life I wanted to do. I just got it for everybody else. At that point in time, I just came out of a meeting with all the staff. I mean, all the staff. Didn't care if they were cooks, chefs, cleaners, players, didn't care. Everybody in here, I'm going to tell you exactly what's going on here. Don't want you to be in the dark. Nothing worse than an industry. Can hear I've got my union hat on again now. I don't care what anybody says. If you're in a job and you've committed to that job, you deserve to be told why there's a problem. So I sat them down, and a lot of people in that meeting. I just went through it, and I don't know how long it took, maybe in an hour or so. And then I said, every single question you want to ask me now, I'm going to answer you. I will answer it honestly. I'm going to stand here and answer every single question, and you're going to get the absolute honest answer from me. And I did. And to be honest, it were very few questions, purely because I'd covered everything when I'd spoken to them. And quite a few that people come up and said, thanks very much for everything you've done, the way you were treated in the period of time you were here. A number of them actually said, why didn't you stay on? I said, I can't stay on and watch somebody get sacked. No chance. Just said, immoral. So I think most of the people and the staff in there knew where I was coming from and what I thought. When I'm walking away, I can do a media, but I've not got a job, but I'll still walk away from it. So when you see me walking outside afterwards, that's drained after having done all that and said to every one of those people, if I can help you in any way, here is my phone number. And if you're players, I'll do the PFA stuff for you. I'll be down south, I'll make calls, I'll give you reference, everything. I'm here for you the entirety of the time. And I hope and think they kind of understood where I was coming from because I was so strong about it. There was one other little thing to do that day, and there was a press conference. Eric and I were asked to go to the press conference and explain what was going on. And I said to John, yeah, I'm happy to do that. I'm going to say exactly what I feel. And they said, well, here's what we want you to say. And I went, no, I'm not even looking at it. I'm going to say what I think. They said, well, in that case, don't bother coming to the press conference. And that was a bit closer John and I got to kind of falling out. Because what I did understand, because we're mature adults, I said to him, I know what you're doing this. The business decision is fine. It makes actually perfect sense. I don't think this club will ever go down. John might disagree and say it might have, but I meant to say to him, you won't put this club under because you know there's a buyer out there for you. So you won't do it. You know, so whether you get the money you wanted for it or not, it will happen. So I don't think there was any real massive anger, just disappointment, really.
So looking at it from a fan's perspective, obviously you're not front and centre or involved in the press conference when administration is announced. Did you feel that some of the blame was put at your door from outsiders because of that, because they weren't seeing you there, when really, as you've explained there, you were actually behind the scenes speaking to the Indians, really? You were speaking to everyone that was involved in the back room staff, the players.
Happy to go to press conferences. Well, yeah, I'll come, yeah. But I'm not here to push a party line. I'm here to tell you what's happened. So that wasn't what was once. And that's just business. I'm walking out there saying, well, I'm sitting out here. If any press guys like talk to me, I'll talk to you. Nobody did. I'm very few did. That was the amazing thing about it. There was no handcuffs, there was no silence, and nothing like that from the club or for John or anyone like that. Nothing like that. Just very few people bothered to ask. Which is pretty amazing. Think about it. How did I feel about it personally? I know this is going to sound really surprising, because from the outside you think, oh, player, international, chief executive, all that money, ego. I don't care what people thought about me. My ego was just unimportant at that point in time. Didn't care. You can think badly of me. I've been in so many situations. Like, I remember leaving Chelsea. This is quite a good analogy. I know it's taken it back a while. I left Chelsea after 5 years. They got relegated in the last day of the season to go down to the second tier. And I was leaving to go to PSG, as it was at the time. It ended up changing to Everton, but it was PSG. The club hadn't offered me a new contract. They needed the money. I'm leaving on the last day of the season when they've got relegated. How's that look? That looks like I've run out of sinking ship, doesn't it? Had they given me a contract and asked me to stay, I'd have stayed. But when I go in and then go out in the press and go, they've done A, B, C, D, E to me. Well, no, I'm not going to do that. The reason being, I don't want to make the football fans feel bad about the club. What's more important? How do you as a fan feel about your entire club? Or how do you feel about one player who's now left? So I remember taking a lot of that at that time. It's just as I'm writing this book just now, I've told that a few times to people, and Chelsea fans now know it. But I wasn't going to go and do that to fans, because fans have to go to work the next day. And, I thought that mate, that he was your favourite player, that part, and he's now slagging your club. No chance. No, I'm not going to do that. I'll take a hit for that. And I was comfortable doing that. It was more important what I thought of them than what they thought of me. So I know that sounds, I don't know if that sounds strange, but that's how I work. And similarly with Kilmarnock, I loved my time at Kilmarnock. Absolutely loved it. From the outside, it looks as if I was shaking to get moved to Motherwell. I wanted to stay. Did at that time I go and say what they've done and welched on their deal with me in two ways, having taken a third of the wages that I was on elsewhere because I wanted to come back to Scotland. I could have done that, but I didn't. I just took a wee bit of a hit. I remember playing for Motherwell down there at Kilmarnock and getting good with those fans that I adored and had been nice to me. And I just thought, it wouldn't change the way I feel about them. They don't know the whole story. Maybe one day they will. But there's no way I'm going to appear at a club in the meantime. So I've got background in being like this. You know, trying to remember, it's just not all about you all the time. You know, there's too many people in this world that it's a wee bit like that. Everything else is secondary in comparison to them. I come from a background where we don't think that way.
And there will be people that suggest that you were overseeing a number of these contracts that perhaps spiralled out of control. Now, you've mentioned John Spencer and Andy Gorham, contracts that you weren't involved in, but there was still a lot of other players. The budget, was that something you were able to keep to, or was the ambitions of John Boyle such that it was impossible to do your own job?
No, the budget was fine. It stayed to the whole time. So for the whole 4 years it was on budget. So that wasn't really that difficult, because, you know, once now and again we had to pay, you know, quite a lot for certain players, but if it's a player like Jed, who was quite well paid, you know, not Spenny style, but, you know, quite well paid. You know, to Scaparri, was, would he have fitted in the wage structure of, you know, Aberdeen, Hibs, Hearts? Yeah, he wouldn't have been a big signing for them. It'd just been another signing for them, you know, another good signing for them. Same with now and again, you had to go slightly above it with what was the average, but that's every football club. As long as my budget was roughly where it should be, because you're given a budget, that's your job as an executive, given a budget, so you stick by it. And that's what I did. So from there, if someone said, oh, you overspent, no, I didn't. You know, I can tell you, I've got the figures. I spent what within the budget, and sometimes underneath it, to be fair. So it doesn't hold water, I'm afraid. Because anyone may argue anything against that. Problem is, I'm the one that had the figures. They aren't. So I know.
And the eventual outcome would be that the club would be saved, the club would continue and continues to play in the top flight of Scottish football many years unbroken, which very few can say, with the exception of Aberdeen and Celtic. It's then Motherwell in terms of a stay in the top flight of the game. Do you now look back on it and look at the current setup at Motherwell, a team under fan ownership, a club under fan ownership, and see the club thriving? That must bring you some satisfaction.
No, it's brilliant. That would be my preferred model of any model in a football club. Problem was, back in that time, with the finances the way they were at other clubs, had Motherwell run it that way, they'd have been in the division below, because they wouldn't have had the money to stay even close to the other clubs, because the money had spiralled with a lot of those other clubs. They were miles and miles. That would have been miles behind the likes of, you know, the clubs that I mentioned before that have basically just got bigger, you know, like customer base, and they could grow up much better. However, the game has changed, and the finances of the game have changed, and they've decreased. And that kind of, that was helpful. Also, the season where Motherwell could have gone down, but obviously the team that was coming up didn't get the stadium.
Yeah, Falkirk Stadium wasn't.
So, you know, it's a technicality. They got away with it, and that's good. I'm delighted they got away with it. But you, when you come out of that, you come out of into an era where the finances are completely different. They're a bit more equalised. The TV deal's completely different. And on top of that, they then run it well, really well within that structure. And I've got nothing but praise. I've got no complaints or anything except, and I love to see the way they're doing it. And as I say, if every club could be like that, it'd be great. Will Motherwell then be able to become the third force in football, in Scottish football? No chance. You know, that, obviously. Because how do you get the funding to do that? You might now and again touch those areas for a tiny wee bit of time, but it will not be sustainable. But that's fine. That's absolutely fine. You know, that's kind of just the way of the world. I'm really happy for them. They've went down a really good route. There've been a lot of people that have put a lot of time and effort into it over that period of time where, you know, the final ownership's been in. And even though it was dangerous, and it really was quite a dangerous thing to do, because, you know, had it not been, you know, taken over by the right group with the right things in mind, I mean, we can all sit here and think really morally pleased with ourselves because you're in the club. Well, other teams such as Rangers had people that came in and run them, and that didn't go well because they didn't choose the right people. And I know that wasn't fan ownership, but you need the right people as well. The fabulous thing is, it seems over the period, over good long decades now, Motherwell have managed to do that. You know, the club have chosen good people, and the fans have chosen good people from within themselves. And you know, that is, for me, the secret of their success now.
And just a final one, you were keen to stress that this wasn't a public slaughtering of John Boyle in any sort of way. What is your relationship like now with John, 17 years on?
I've spoken to him once, I think, with some illness in his family. And I had a really nice chat, you know, kind of jumped by. It was good 3 years later. Kind of, if I met on the street or a bar or whatever, we'd have a nice chat, I'm sure. But, like, other than that period of Motherwell, we'd only met each other a few times before. So it's not like best mates never see each other again. It's not like that. And also, the other thing you need to remember about football in the wider sense, you know, you're sometimes playing with guys after my first five years with Everton, then up Chelsea, then Everton, then Tranmere. You're working for 5 years with people who you're with them every single day, and you think they're the best mates in the world. And you always think at that point in time, like most players, you will be my friends for life. And then you never see them again. It's just the way it is. You move on. And that's kind of the way it is in this business. There's very, very few who you stay closely in touch with, be they players, be they your manager, be they coaches. When you meet them, it's great. But do you spend a lot of time with them? No. Well, why should you? They weren't necessarily your best mates. They were work colleagues. And you moved on, and so did they. So from the outside, it may go, wow, you've not spoken to him. Well, I've not spoken to such a shirt for all those years, and I liked him as well. So it's exactly the same. And I don't put any difference on somebody who was a chairman, an owner, or somebody who was the secretary, or somebody who was a cleaner, or somebody who was a left back, or somebody a youth team player. I don't take any bigger or lesser importance in that friendship. But when you meet them, you're just the same person.
And of course, you've not went back into that sort of role within football, but you're still a prominent figure within the game, regular in Five Live. You've talked about your books coming out. Can you tell us a wee bit more about them just before we finish up?
No, I've been fortunate quite a lot of things. I've done a lot of work for media around, you know, most people don't know most of the work I'm doing because I try to keep it all separate. So, you know, for a long time I did quite a lot of work in Scotland, but I was doing a lot of work in England as well. If you do a lot of work everywhere in the same people see you all the time, you get fed up at sight. You're fed up at sight, I mean. So, I mean, I'd be working for Satan in Ireland, I'd be working for BBC in Scotland, I'd be working for Five Live or Channel 5 in England. I currently work for World Service, I work for Chelsea. Most of my time's now spent down south doing that. I write a great deal. I put off writing a book for a long time, this book that I wanted to write for a long time, but 4 weeks ago, something clicked, and I said, I can go sit down. And that's 75,000 words later. Here's the good news for anyone at Motherwell. You don't need to put off any of that stuff first, because book number one finishes the day that I leave Everton. So I don't get to anywhere close to Motherwell. If I ever get round to book number two, that'll take us to the end of my career at Motherwell. But we shall see if I get round to that. And if I get past that, it'll be book number three, which will be all the things I did in the media, and all the other things I did around it that people won't be aware of. It's not how I'm great, it's actually just laughing at the madness of it all. And I'll be absolutely honest with you, the most fun bit to write of all of my career and time that I write about will actually be the time at Motherwell, because it was so weird. I've got so many good stories about it, and there's a bit of me that really, really wants to do it. But I will do one thing, I will make this promise. I'll get in touch with John Boyle before I do it, before I publish it. I kind of should run by it, because he would want to see it on it. But when I say run by it, it's just that I would be a kind of, look, this is how I saw it, mate. And if you want to argue with him or change him, you can try. But who knows if that will ever come out. But do you know what? I will write it, because the joy of it. I'm sitting talking to you now laughing at the thought of it, because so many things that happened were brilliant, and I'm dying to tell those stories.
And I'll put you in the spot just before you go. I've never actually asked a guest to pick the closing music, but I know you're obviously a huge music fan. Give us a song to play us out.
Oh, God, that's... right, just off the top of my head, because it could be a billion songs, there could be so many, but I went to see one of my favourite live bands, it's not my favourite live band, just a couple of weeks ago. And if you need to know how you live life, listen to Flaming Lips and Do You Realise? It's a cracker.
No problem, Pat. That's what will play us out today. Thank you very much for your time. This has been absolutely fascinating. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
No problem at all. And there's plenty more stories, and the fun ones will come in the book, but I had to keep some back.
Oh, well, that's a wee bit of a disappointment there to finish off.
We've been here for 5 hours.